Hello everyone, I'm Marco.
And I'm Tamar.
And this is...
Once Upon a Sushi!
Welcome back. So, in the last episode, we were talking about the history of sushi. We talked about the origin from the rice paddies of China to the food stalls of Tokyo, from fermentation to ready-made on-the-spot eating of sushi. And today we're going to talk about gender roles, and then we're going to talk about overfishing. So, Tamar, what can you tell me?
About gender.
About gender.
So
enlighten me.
I will enlighten you. So traditionally, sushi has been a very male-oriented business.
Of course.
Of course, many things, as we know. And there is various reason that they gave for this phenomena throughout history. For example, they talked about body temperature. They would say that body temperature of a woman is higher than a man's. So in order for it to be, for her to be able to make the sushi, as we talked about before, the making of the sushi itself.
Is that true? Or
no, that's a complete,
body temperature?
That is, not only is that not true, it's actually exactly the opposite. There is actually a study published in 1998 that says that the body of the woman, the temperature of a woman is actually lower.
Interesting.
So of course that's not true. Also, another thing that they would talk about is the use of perfume and cosmetics of women, you know, because women have to smell good, you know. That's the only women use perfumes and cosmetics, and of course that is can't be anywhere near the sushi. And actually, when I was in London a couple of weeks ago, right now, I wanted to go to a sushi restaurant, and on their website it said that they asked the consumer not to come with any perfume or strong laundry detergent if they're gonna sit at the bar, which is crazy, you know.
That's funny. We actually had, in one of the restaurants I was working, we had on the reservation system for one of our regulars, there was a note every time they would reserve a table, there was a note from the kitchen to put their table as far away from the kitchen as possible, because this woman was always wearing so much perfume.
And they say it changed the...
Yeah, it was an open kitchen, so they were like, put them far away, please.
No, that's... Wow.
Yeah. So it's a little bit understandable, but I mean, it's definitely still, like, not...
Yeah,
not...
but there's a difference between telling the consumer,
no,
please...
No, it's still not a reason to exclude women.
Of course. Also, another thing, as we know, menstruation is something that men are very, you know, they love talking about menstruation as if they understand.
And I know,
of course, I know you do. And what people talk about menstruation, they think that, you know, as menstruating women, we cannot keep our senses intact. So our tastes are off, and we can't really taste, you know, the very intricate things that are needed in order to be a sushi. I'm never gonna say this word correctly. A sushi chef. Obviously, all of those reasons, none of these reasons have been proven. Actually, some of them have been completely debunked, and we know that it's the exact opposite.
So it's just good old-fashioned sexism.
Exactly, and it's not even old-fashioned, which is the sad part. But this makes the entrance of women into sushi kitchens, my God, a very, almost an impossible task.
Until now, or is it changing?
No. I mean, it is changing, I will get to that, but it's still something, as we know, a very big problem for women to be included in kitchens and in general in the workforce. Another thing that is talked about is not only in the sushi kitchens, is something that is talked about all throughout the work industry, is that, you know, women can't work hard in long hours because it's very unfitting, and they need, you know, a more delicate and less physically demanding job, which is also obviously untrue. And it's another form of block for women to enter these kinds of work environments.
So obviously now we see like the role of the women in like making sushi is mm-hmm. like non-existent. How is it like as consumers, like as we saw in the last episode, like the development of the street food sushi was mostly because like workers were going out, spending their money, and like mm-hmm. In the nightlife of Tokyo, going for out for sushi. Were there also women? How was the story with consumption of sushi with women?
This is actually crazy. Like after I read this information, I was shocked to find out that actually until 1999. Okay, 1999. We were all born by then. I mean, most of us in this room were born by then. There was actually a law that prohibited women from working past 10 p.m. I'm going back for the workforce for a minute mm-hmm. and I will get into the consumerism. But they actually didn't allow women to work after 10 p.m., which makes them, in Japan, which makes operating, you know, working in sushi,
impossible because it was a nighttime thing.
Exactly what you talked about, consumerism. Yeah. And we're talking like this is now. This is not, some faraway land. So obviously, if we're talking about things that come up until a very recent time, of course, the consumption also had a lot of taboos around it. And it's still seen weirdly for a woman to come into a sushi restaurant and consume sushi alone, which is, I mean, also a very...
Oh, you need a man to go out to eat sushi.
Exactly. It's for them to enter a sushi restaurant and sit alone and eat the sushi alone is something that is seen very weirdly. And, even today, when women walk in and sit down, they're politely mistreated. They would be asked to leave, which I think, politely mistreated is very funny.
That's a nice oxymoron, yeah.
Yeah, and also regarding that, I think I really think it's funny that the man in this situation, the sushi chef that is politely mistreating this woman, of course she can't politely mistreat him back, right? Because if we're talking about women in culture right now, women are programmed in, I'm doing hand, what is this called?
Air quotes.
Women are programmed to be very polite, very... We have to nod and be very proper. And of course, if in this situation, the woman is trying to be...
It's a very one-sided power dynamic.
Exactly. If she says, like, excuse me, but no, I'm not leaving. Like, I want to eat my sushi. Of course, it's not gonna... Yeah.
Fun fact!
If you want to be a fun fact...
Or not so funny fun fact, actually. This is something related that you actually, Tamar, said before about how women are not appreciated in a sushi restaurant. And actually, before, when a woman would enter in a restaurant and order some pieces of sushi, the owner or the chef would send a green tea to this woman. And now you would think, oh, they send it for free to actually give her something to drink while she was eating. Actually, what will happen is that they will invite her to kindly exit the restaurant.
Politely.
Exactly. Green tea was the symbol of end of the dish. So actually they were telling her to get up and head to the door and leave the restaurant.
Politely spill the tea. I'm a sushi master at this point. And not so politely leave the
not very like. Not very lady.
Not very ladylike. I have no place in a sushi restaurant. Very not so funny fact.
Not at all.
So actually the creation of a conveyor belt sushi is somehow helping equalize the sushi consumption, the sushi industry in whole. Because when you don't have a sushi master sitting in front of you, then there's no one there to send you that green tea. So it became a lot easier for women as consumers to sit down at a restaurant. And also because the sushi master isn't in front of you, it became easier for women in the kitchen to be also a part of this situation. But it's still a very, you know, serious subject. Obviously, we know that gender equality is, we're far from it. But these kinds of things are, you know, are a good sign for the future. There's still people who will not eat sushi if it's made from a female chef. But new restaurants are opening, female-owned restaurants, you know, and the media is kind of shifting into a situation where they know that this is a major problem that needs to be fixed. So hopefully this part of the story will come back to origin in a podcast in, I don't know, 20 years from now. Hopefully.
100 years.
Yeah, probably 100 years. Sadly.
Now we get to the chapter with my favorite title. Many fish, few fish.
Very songy.
So throughout its history, the making and the consumption of food in general has seen trends in style and ingredients. All over the world we can see this, no? And we now want to take a deeper look into the development of the species that were consumed for sushi. We touched on the subject in the last episode for a little bit. The first species of, the first variety of fish to be used in sushi, even if we go back to the origins in China, was sweetwater carp.
Yeah, this is what we talked about in the beginning.
Exactly. So the sweetwater carp is, of course, a lot different from the fish that now we eat with sushi, which is mostly a fish that comes from the sea.
Yeah.
And it's also because it's raw. So the reason for this change is, like, for the carp, being a sweet water fish, has many more parasites than seawater fish.
Which probably was what needed, why it needed to be fermented. They understood that they couldn't.
Either it needed to be fermented, or the fermentation made it possible to eat it. Like, it's vice versa.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, exactly. It's,
we will never really know. But
chicken or the egg.
Exactly. So, but in the beginning, we had the carp used as the fish in sushi. And then these changed when in Japan, and we also touched on the subject in the last episode, with the food taboos that we have in Japan, originating from Buddhism or also from Shinto, where animal flesh for food consumption was a taboo.
So they needed to find a solution to consuming something else.
Yeah, and like so animal meats, like land animals, fish was excluded from that. So that swayed the consumption to the many different fish that Japan could find in the sea.
Yeah, it's interesting how religion really changes the way that, you know, we consume
definitely,
things.
Yeah.
In Judaism also, there's you know, there's this dish. There's a lot of dishes that are like this, but there's a dish that was intended to answer the problem of not cooking in Shabbat. So Saturday is resting day, is holy day, and you're not supposed to cook or work or many other things. But the solution to it, and you can find it throughout many different Jewish, how do you say?
Communities,
thank you, English. There is a dish that's called chamin or chunt, it depends on where you come from, that you basically you cook it in the oven overnight for 12 hours.
The day before,
exactly. And then in the morning, it's ready to eat. You don't have to cook anything and you have a hot meal.
Smart.
Yeah. So, I mean, religion, we can say a lot of things, but it brought us some very amazing food.
Yeah, and in this case, the taboo of not eating animal meat also, obviously, it changed the taste of the people. So what we find in Japan is an aversion of oily tastes and also less spices used in this period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But we see a very broad consumption of fish. And for sushi, we have we had different kinds of fish that were used. We saw a little bit before, I want to get into that again. the most popular fish to be used for sushi was the white meat fish called gizzard shad.
This is such a funny name. I just have to say.
it's better in Japanese. It's kohada in Japanese, which is not popular in Western countries. You don't see that a lot outside of Japan. Also, we have the shirao, the white bait, which apparently was a favorite of Shogun Ieyasu Tokugawa.
Oh, of course.
Who was the one who conquered and unified Japan in the 1600s. So that also what was of a spread probably of this variety of fish.
Celebrity style sushi.
Yeah, of course. You always want to eat the food of the stars.
Yeah.
And then we have other fish that were considered excellent for sushi making, but incredibly expensive. So there we have like a distinction between classes. For example, we have tai, that is definitely the most adored fish for sushi. It's a Pagus major species of sea bream. White meat fish, and it's considered the best fish for sushi making.
Say what? Fun fact? Did you know the Thai fish that you just mentioned is actually, it's been considered the best fish to make sushi for a long time. Many places still consider it the best fish to make sushi in Japan. It might not be the most expensive anymore, as we will see for various reasons, but it's still one of the most consumed. And it's so important that actually in Japanese language and way of saying, tai comes up many times. One way of saying, translated in English roughly, says, even when rotten, it's still tai. That gives you an importance.
Oh, that even when the tai is rotten, it's still good.
It's still tai.
Okay,
so
okay.
It's still considered an amazing fish.
I think I'm changing my name.
Yeah.
To tai?
Yeah.
But not only that, there is actually a town, a port town called Toyohama near Hiroshima,
mm-hmm.
And they throw every year a massive festival completely dedicated to Thai.
Wow.
So they create this 80 meters long reproduction of a Thai fish that flies around the festival, and they have strict vendors all around the place. This is the importance of Thai fish.
So when is this festival, you know? Asking for a friend.
Let's go.
Fortunately, I don't have the date, but we'll find it.
So to go on with varieties of fish that were used, or like are used for sushi, we have the angava, which is an adductor muscle of flatfish. It's considered a delicacy and even more appreciated than toro. The toro is the fat tuna.
We love the toro.
Now probably I consider the one of the best fish for sushi. We're gonna get into that a little bit later. Saba or mackerel is also very appreciated when it's cooked.
Saba in Hebrew is grandfather.
Yeah, fun.
Yeah, very fun.
this is one of the examples. Like also like different fish have different uses. So this one, like mackerel, is mostly used when it's cooked. Because it's a very, very flavorful fish. And then we have other species than fish. We have uri, which is a sea urchin. We have unagi, which is a freshwater eel.
Unagi.
We have ika, which is squid. We have kampachi, which is a wild-caught yellow-tailed tuna fish. Then we have mirugai, which are giant clams, which this one I find very interesting. I've never seen a clam
on a sushi.
Which is a very interesting.
I think they use it in like more of a sashimi. I've tasted it like that. I've never tasted it.
Yeah. So this is like a whole variety of fish, and after World War II, actually the rationing of various sorts of foods led to even more. Use of types of fish, ones that were previously unused,
mm-hmm.
Like mullet, poisonous puffer fish was starting to be used, snake heads, and more clams.
Actually, interesting enough, regarding the puffer fish, there is records from the 1700s from a Japanese cookbook that the earliest record of a rolled sushi was actually wrapped in poisonous blowfish skin.
Oh, so not seaweed, but...
Yeah, but you know, it sounds so mean. Like, here, have some, you know, sushi wrapped with poisonous blowfish skin, my love, you know, it's...
That's interesting, yeah. So the World War II obviously changed a little bit the landscape of things that were used. Also, not only fish, but also vegetables were used, obviously, more affordable. For example, we have the kappamaki, also one that is very popular today, which is the cucumber maki.
Eine lustige Tatsache.
Did you know that the kappamaki, the cucumber roll, and this is one of my favorite facts of the entire podcast. I love this one.
I'm excited for this one.
All fun facts are the kappamaki good facts.
Take its name from a mythical water sprite, so a mythical creature, like a spirit. This spirit, called the kappa, is known for eating children.
Oh my god.
So it's a water creature that eats children and then goes under the skirts of women to spy the women. And when it doesn't eat the kids, the only thing that the kappa eats, it's cucumbers. And that's why the kappamaki is called like that.
That is so random. It's so much information to one creature.
Okay, so let's get back to fish from vegetables.
It's gonna be hard to continue on that now.
More specifically, I wanna talk about tuna. So tuna in sushi, it's like nowadays it's omnipresent. It wasn't always like that. We were talking about that before a little bit. Tuna was actually considered a meat that was like very poor, like you wouldn't even feed it to a dog. And the two reasons are, on one hand, the aspect of the red meat that, again, with the food taboos that we had, like the reminder of red meat, and it was said it has like a bloody taste, so that was like not considered a good fish. And the other reason was that before refrigeration, tuna was very prone to deterioration. So it was it's not easy to keep tuna fresh for a long time without refrigerating it. Like nowadays, it's mostly frozen and then consumed to get rid of all the parasites. That changed in the 1840s. So what happened in the 1840s, and this is actually almost a fun fact, like one day these fishermen went out to fish, and alas, they fished a lot of tuna that day, like enormous amounts of tuna, never seen before amounts of tuna. They come back and they have all this tuna. Following the rules of the market, this tuna, obviously, because it's so much, it's very cheap. So the sushi vendors sell it very cheap as a cheap source of protein for the workers. And this is the point where it kind of takes off. It's still a low-class fish for sushi, but it's cheap and it gets...
So from one instant...
Basically, yeah.
It
basically
became something bigger.
Yes.
That's crazy.
So yeah, it will still take a long time until tuna is considered a more higher quality fish.
You mean back then?
Back.
You mean the where... From then till where we are now, which tuna is considered?
Yes. To realize like how massive this change was, I mean, we only have to see how tuna fishing has changed until today. No, I mean today most of the tuna is fished in the Atlantic, frozen on the boats, brought to Japan, auctioned off at this very famous market in Tokyo, and then sent back to the USA.
which was actually, you know, it used to be open to the public, this market. When I was in Japan, I think 2 years ago, they made it closed. I think because of a lot of things that had to do with overfishing, people came and took pictures and kind of made this whole thing around it. And I was bummed. I really wanted to go and see.
That's sad.
Yeah.
Fatto divertente.
Did you know? And this is a fact collected by the Guinness World Record.
Wow, okay? Official fact.
Official fact. So the most expensive bluefin tuna ever sold was sold for 333,600,000 yen.
Ah, okay, yen.
Okay, I got you.
You got me.
Which is 3,082,610 euros, or in pounds,
oh my god,
2,431,410 pounds.
Wait, that's like one whole fish.
Yeah, that's what I was about to ask.
That's one fish that weighed 278 kilos.
270 kilos?
Yeah. They get big.
That's insane.
Yeah.
They get pretty big. And it was sold to Sushi Zanmai of Kiyomura Corporation of Japan at the annual auction of the Toyosu Market in Kyoto. In Tokyo. Tokyo. Not Kyoto.
Close.
This sales happened on the 5th of January 2019.
Oh, so that's almost like actually, now.
Yeah, the
So was it like, what makes it so expensive? Is it the size or is it?
Generally, what Japanese consumer value the most is both the color and the fattiness of the tuna.
Okay.
How so funny is that they used to not consume tuna because of the color, and yeah. Now one of the aspects that yeah. you yeah. look
But
for.
That's part of the changing consumption. Even the fatty part of the tuna that is now consumed, as you said before, the oily taste wasn't appreciated before,
mm-hmm.
and now with the change, the fat part of the toro part of the tuna is actually very, very expensive.
Wow, I don't like. I feel like we just found out that a tuna is worth more than. Me. That's really sad.
No one would pay that much for you, that's true. Sad. I'm sorry.
You're such a great friend.
So yeah, no, I mean that really shows like how sought after tuna is now in sushi.
Mm-hmm.
And it just adds to the problem, no? It's the demand is so high that tuna farming is getting bigger and bigger, and it's a problem because tuna farming works. They catch the tuna and then put it in the cages. You can't really make it reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
So you catch it when they're young, you put it in these huge nets, cages in the sea.
And they make them grow.
And you feed them. And this creates a whole lot of problems. There's the use of medicine that then gets products. Into the water, antibiotics. Yeah. There's the feces of the fish that sink to the ground and make everything die. Like nothing can grow there anymore. So there is a very big problem. Also, like the food. That farmed fish eat. I mean,
the fish meal.
Yeah, tuna is a carnivore. He eats other fish. So what do you feed him? You feed him other fish, and the production of fish meal for tuna farming is fished elsewhere, like the coast of Africa and the coast of South America, like everywhere.
And there's no.
And it's like they fish everything. Like it doesn't matter what kind of fish it is. So there's a massive overfishing problem with that.
Like in salmon, as we know.
Also in salmon, I was about to mention that. So what about salmon? Salmon is not really consumed in sushi in Japan. It's a thing in the U.S. It's a thing in Europe, and it did actually start. With the salmon industry. Salmon industry was trying to sell more salmon, so they used sushi as a vehicle to sell more salmon. That's like... And we have the exactly same problems there with salmon farming and tuna farming. Also with eels. Eels is actually, maybe this is also a little bit of a fun fact, at least. Well, it's a mystery fact. So eels, we don't know a lot about eels. What we know is there is basically one species of eels everywhere in the world. So if you go to a mountain river in, I don't know, Europe, or you go to Asia, it is the same eel genetically. And no one knows how they mate. No one, no researcher has ever seen a mating eel.
They
roughly know where it happens. It's in the Bermuda Triangle. But basically,
of course, where all the weird stuff happens
of course,
in the world.
But
yeah.
Basically all the eels in the world, when they are mature, they go back to this area, they mate, and they go back again. It's a very weird phenomenon.
That's kind of scary.
So also with eels, the reproducing, the artificial reproducing, or like the farming is very difficult, and it's done in the same way as with salmon and with tuna.
If I can add something to this conversation, it's not really a fun fact, but talking about the salmon farming, most people don't know that the salmons that are farmed are actually not pink in color.
Oh yeah.
That pink orange color is fed to the salmon as a colorant, because naturally that color would come from the krills that they eat in the sea.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously in a cage, they're not gonna get that color. So their skin is sort of pale gray or that sort of whitish color, and they are fed the colorant in order to reach a certain level of similarity with the wild-caught salmon.
So if you eat a salmon sashimi with wasabi made of horseradish, none of it is real.
What is
not the colors.
Real?
What is real? It's like the new... It's
do
we like,
even choose to eat the sushi, you know?
Yeah,
free just, will.
It's a food surrealism.
Yeah, and next episode we talk about meta...
Well, I mean, this begs the question, what is the future of sushi, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't really do any research about it, but like...
I mean, if we could, we'd be millionaires seeing into the future, you know?
Of course. But I mean, we can imagine some parts. Maybe there's gonna be a same development as in that we have in meat, like with artificial meat.
Yeah.
So that might be a possible road where sushi is gonna develop.
Yeah.
The interesting thing here, I think, like sushi is maybe nowadays more diverse than ever,
mm-hmm.
and. Maybe this kind of like flexibility and this kind of also like adaptability that we have seen, like, is also in the history of sushi. You know, it's a long history of adaptability and like a big range of different kinds of sushi. So maybe that can also help to like put it go into the future with it. I mean, more vegetable sushi. More sushi with meat alternative, maybe not, yeah, but like kind of like tofu, whatever. Like
the problem with, I think, with this as an all traditional food, as we see, this is an extremely traditional food. I think traditions don't allow for a lot of space for innovation, and a lot of times innovation brings maybe new things that are better, but it also takes away, again with the air quotes. I keep forgetting that you can only hear me and not see me. Something, you know, that is not traditional.
But we are a long way from traditions, aren't we? I mean, we are not in the traditional Japan Edo period where it's like strict use of certain. Products like sushi can be everything now, and it's sold everywhere. You can buy it in the supermarket, you can go to a fine dining sushi restaurant, you have the whole range, you have all ingredients.
Yeah.
I mean, you can look on the internet and find abominations like dessert sushi or like anything, like it's
the banana sushi.
It's really limitless. So.
But see, even with your use of abomination, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Like, how far can we go with trying to make sushi a more sustainable, let's say, thing? Can we go from tradition? Because there needs to be some middle ground. But we will see, you know. Time will tell.
It's gonna stay interesting.
Stay interesting.
And who knows, maybe we'll be able to do another podcast in the future. This was really fun. And yeah, we thank you again for listening. This was the second and final episode. I hope you had as much fun as we had making it. And we wish you a good night.
And a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Or Happy Easter.
Hanukkah. Right, we're not Christmas. This is... I'm Jewish, I don't know.
Happy Halloween.
Yeah, sure.